Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College, all things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there, and of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. We have many conflicting reports from the Middle East, so there's no one better to turn to than the former ambassador of Israel to the United States, Dr. Michael Oren, who will soon unveil his podcast. I just put out the address for the podcast, Dr. Oren, so I'm hoping we finally get to see one this week or listen to one. I see there's a trailer for Clarity, so eventually there will be a podcast.
There will be a podcast, indeed. God willing, there's coming. If we stop the war for 30 hours and I can stop getting on TV, maybe I can get the podcast out. That's what happens here.
I want to recommend you stop doing everything except the Hugh Hewitt Show. Dr. Oren, there are many reports. What do we make of the negotiations with Hamas? Because Hamas fired a barrage of rockets from the north this morning. So I don't know if they got word up in the north, mm-hmm. they're terrorists in the north, that there are peace talks going on.
Oh, the firing from the north, if it indeed was Hamas, but it was Hamas' way of showing, you know, to its constituencies in the Middle East that it's still capable of firing rockets, because it's increasingly difficult for Hamas to fire rockets out of Gaza itself. Okay, that's quite unrelated to what's going on in the negotiations. The negotiations are very simple. I think Israel is willing to agree to a hostage release, and the numbers vary between 20 and 40, something around the area of 33. And the priority would be given to the ill, the aged, the in any way handicapped, challenged, physically challenged people, perhaps even emotionally challenged people. Those, I think that's going to be a relative term because everyone's going to be emotionally challenged. And then the length of the ceasefire. And Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire. It wants Israel to declare that it lost the war, to withdraw to the border. And Hamas also wants to see great numbers of prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, released from Israeli jails, as much as 50 Palestinian prisoners for every hostage released. And that is a very difficult climb for Israel, because these are Palestinian prisoners who have killed Israelis, have blood on their hands. And you have to go explain to the families of those victims why their loved ones aren't coming home, but these guys get good to go home to a hero's welcome. That's a very difficult demand for Israel to meet, but I think there's going to be flexibility there. Israel would be willing to release some prisoners, put it that way. It all depends on whether Hamas is convinced that it can hold on and hold on indefinitely, and eventually the world will impose a ceasefire on Israel. And that's the message that Hamas has received from a number of foreign capitals. At times it receives it from Washington, D.C., though most recently President Biden joined with the nation, with the heads of 17 other nations, pinning the blame on Hamas and calling for Hamas to release all the hostages, which is very good, finally. But a lot of damage has been done. A lot of messages have been internalized by Hamas that it can hold on. And eventually, you know, someone will come along and impose a ceasefire, and Hamas won't have to give up anything. But let's be very realistic, and this is a supercharged issue here, Hugh, that even if Israel were to pull out indefinitely, you know, to the border, declare the end of the war, Hamas still wouldn't give up all the hostages. It's always going to keep several hostages for a rainy day. And this is what we're dealing with Hamas. The one good sign we've seen is the release of two videos this week. I'm sure you've been following this. One, yes, by two Americans, by the way, in those videos. Of course, one Hirsch, Goldberg, Poland. You know, they come out with strong statements against Netanyahu, against the government, calls for immediate impermanent ceasefire to release all the hostages. But it's also showing that Hamas is under pressure as Israel prepares to invade its incursion into Rafah.
Dr. Oren, I have one big question. No one covers this. More than 260 IDF soldiers have fallen in Gaza's war. What do their families, what do the other troops think about throwing up their hands and saying, okay, I'll alley in free, Hamas can stay in Rafah?
They're saying a lot. Well, you have an entire generation of Israeli young people who have fought in this war, literally tens and tens of thousands of people. And in the year before the war, during the great struggles here over the judicial reform, the army got very politicized with units, particularly elite units and pilots, saying they wouldn't report for reserve duty. So let a certain genie out of the bottle. Now the army acts as almost kind of another branch of government, a fourth branch of government. And if Israel wanted to withdraw from Gaza in any way, like unconditionally, certainly, the army would have something to say about it. You're going to see soldiers take to the streets. And in contrast to the period before the war, where most of those protesting came from the left secular part of the Israeli political spectrum, these soldiers would come from the other part of the political spectrum, the religiously observant and right-wing sector, which makes up about half of all of the officers in our combat units and our infantry units. And they're going to have something to say, certainly. Again, you can't put that genie back in the bottle, and we're going to see the political impact of the army on future Israeli decision-making.
So yesterday, CNN came out with a poll, and Joe Biden's handling of the Israel issue has cost him dearly, and not just among young voters who think he's too hard on the Palestinians, but among everybody else who think he's way too soft on the Palestinians. In fact, it looks like on the internals that Joe Biden is losing the election among a large group of independents, a huge group of independents, because he hasn't sided with Israel. So I'm not quite sure how to read that, but what do you think is going to happen here? Because if Israel pulls out without going into Rafah, I am going to be stunned.
Let me just take it in a different direction, if I could. I had an article I posted yesterday on the Clarity Substack called A Page from the 1968 Rebellion. And there's lots of comparisons between what's going on American campuses and what happened in 1968, 56 years ago. Particularly, they all started at Columbia in 1968. They bled onto other campuses, and the violence and the upheaval climaxed at the Chicago Democratic Convention. But, of course, the Democratic Convention is going to be held in Chicago this summer, and I'm sure there's going to be mass demonstrations there. And I made a number of comparisons. You know, the revolts in the 1960s were mostly anti-war. They were about love. These demonstrations are in favor of war. They're in favor of jihad. They're in favor of intifada. And they're not about love. They're about hatred, particularly hatred of Jews. But one interesting comparison would be that what happened as a result of 1968 was that the Democrats lost the presidential election of 1968, because many Americans looking at the chaos on these campuses said, listen, we don't want this. We want order. You know, we've got lives to lead. And strangely enough, there's an article in the New York Times today that says exactly that. It says that Biden is losing voters who are looking at the situation on campuses and saying, we don't want this. So history could repeat itself. The Biden administration is now coming out again and saying that it condemns acts of demonstrations, but it's not acts of anti-Semitism, but it's not condemning the demonstrations itself. And last week, I'm an alumnus of Columbia, and the Jewish alumni of Columbia asked me to represent them in the press and in other political forums. And I've been doing that. I had an article in The Wall Street Journal about a week and a half ago about this. But about a couple days ago, I came out with a call to President Biden to ask the FBI to investigate what's happening on these campuses. Because if you look at the pictures, Hugh, it's all the same tents. Look at that. Yep. There we go. It's the same tents. Especially look at the Columbia ones, it's all green tents. Who's providing these tents? Who's providing the flags? Who's shipping in all of these outside protesters? And most of the people have been arrested. A lot of campuses are not even students. So it's clearly this is being funded and organized in an attempt not to just to transform American policy from pro to anti-Israel. The chance is an effort here to subvert American higher education, and may have far-reaching ramifications in terms of American stability and order. So there's been no response to that, whether or not anybody's willing to investigate who's behind these protests. And so I think Americans are going to be nervous. And
At Clarity, yeah. I don't know if you saw the Journal this morning. This is the headline at the Journal this morning. New York City's Jewish population under, quote, dark cloud as tensions rise. Feelings of fear and insecurity among Jews on Manhattan's Upper West Side as Middle East conflict rages. I thought that there are fear among Jews everywhere in the United States. And I am astonished by these campuses, because they're going to be liable if a Jewish student gets hurt or, God forbid, killed. Because it's imminently foreseeable that there is violence in the heart of these demonstrators, who are not demonstrators. They're actually very bad actors. And they're going to end up with a pogrom of some sort rolling along on one of these campuses. And wherever it happens, it's imminently foreseeable. You're not a lawyer. I am. That matters a lot in tort liability. And Columbia's endowment and Harvard's endowment, all these Tony schools that are allowing this to go on, they're all at risk, Michael Oren.
They are. And here, President Shafik of Colombia is negotiating now for days and days with these demonstrators, giving them extensions of 48 hours each time. And she's negotiating over the number of tents. Get this, over the number of tents, not over the fact that Jewish students feel physically, emotionally threatened on campus, or that even people on the Upper West Side feel physically threatened. He's not negotiating over that. Well, they're trying to curtail some hate speech. But it's really about it is such a flaccid response, and it's not a no-win situation. And I think you'll appreciate something I wrote in this clarity piece is that, you know, back in 1968. The university, the academia, knew what it was fighting for. Students studied Western civilization to appreciate Western civilization. The university was proudly pro-American. Today, the university has no idea what it stands for, and doesn't know what it can fight for against these demonstrations. So the demonstrations, it sort of philosophically, intellectually, have an upper hand. And the university can do is negotiate about the number of tents and not about the ideas. They can't really mount a serious philosophical or intellectual counteroffensive.
People forget Eisenhower was the president of Colombia before he became president of the United States. That's where Colombia used to be, probably long before you were there. But it was in the DNA of Colombia to be Western civilization oriented and led by Eisenhower. Michael, we're going to go to a break in just a second. Before we do, do you expect a ceasefire agreement to actually materialize? We'll talk about it during the break, but I just want, do you expect it actually to work? Because Hamas has not been reasonable for 6 months. Do you think they're going to suddenly be reasonable?
I think that there's a good chance. I can't call it an excellent chance. And there are intensive negotiations. I think we have to look at the possibility if Hamas again says no. And what happens then? A very influential column by Tom Friedman 2 days ago, which obviously was dictated to him by the White House, setting out a vision that if Israel foregoes invading Rafah, if it agrees to let the Palestinian Authority be part of a day-after scenario of governing Gaza, then perhaps there'll be an international Arab force to take over Gaza. There'll be peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia, and there'll be a regional alliance against Iran led by the United States. So that's a very rosy vision. It's being debated and discussed here very intensely. I'm on the news, so I frequently hear that is the subject.
Okay, I'm going to come right back with Dr. Oren for five more minutes. Don't go anywhere, America. Five more minutes with Dr. Oren. I am back with Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador to Israel to the United States. When you said influential column by Tom Friedman, I almost laughed. I don't think he has any influence. I think he's a good stenographer for the White House, but I also don't think the White House gets – the CNN poll shows us they don't get what Americans want out of the Middle East policy of the United States, which is to back Israel and get this over with. Is there a growing sense in Israel, Dr. Oren, that we got to go into Rafah, we got to get these 10,000 armed Hamas Harris, we got to get Sinwar and save as many hostages as we can? Because it looks to me like Hamas is dragging their feet again.
When I say that Tom Friedman's column is influential, it's not influential in the United States, it's influential in Israel. It is. And it gets people talking here, it becomes a headline here. And, there are people from sort of the left side of the political spectrum who will say, let's take the deal. You know, we're going to go into Rafah. We're going to be condemned by the world. We won't be able to save a lot of hostages. Wouldn't it be better not to go into Rafah, strike the deal with the Biden administration, get as many hostages back as possible, get an inter-Arab force into Gaza, get peace with Saudi Arabia, get a regional alliance against Iran. I mean, really, that's a small price to pay for allowing two battalions of Hamas to remain underground and cut off from their supplies. That's the argument. My counterpoint is to raise certain questions.
The poll shows it's going to be President Trump in January. President Trump said on this show 3 weeks ago, Israel has to finish the job. They need to win. They need a victory. That means going into Rafah. That means securing the corridor. Is anyone like Gantz speaking up against this appeasement that's going on?
First of all, let me just say, this is not a partisan statement. Between now and January is a very long time. Even if Trump were to win the election, it would be a long time before he actually becomes president. So, and that's, even a week is a long time in a Middle Eastern war. And I don't think you can base anybody's policy making on what's going to happen next January. You have to see what's going to happen in the next 48 hours, next 78 hours, 72 hours. And keep in mind that while these negotiations are going on in Gaza over the possible hostage release, there are 80 to 100,000 Israelis who are still homeless, displaced by the firing up north. Israeli soldiers under fire every single day. One of them just – my son was at the funeral for one of them, a 27-year-old young commander who was scheduled to get married in 2 weeks. And they're just like sitting ducks up there, getting hit again and again and again. So the situation is utterly intolerable. It's not as if we can just run out the clock here. It's not going to work. And so we have to make a decision. I think the Israeli people, quite apart from what President Biden is saying, that people are waiting, are we willing to cut a deal for a temporary ceasefire in return for, you know, 33 hostages? I think they'd do it. I really do. But barring that, if Hamas says no, or if Hamas gets into a negotiation, well, we're not going to give you 33, but we'll give you 19. And it won't be 6 weeks of a ceasefire. It'll be 2 months of a ceasefire. I think Israel is not going to go down that rabbit hole. No way. No, we're not going
to
play that.
That game. Is what I wanted to hear. I know they're playing you.
And Tom Friedman's article went a step further. It was very clear. This is what he said. He says, yes, the Biden administration is saying publicly that if Israel can present a plan for removing Palestinian civilians from the combat area that convinces us in the White House, we will give a green light to the incursion in Rafah. Tom Friedman says that's not true, that there's actually no plan that would be acceptable to the Biden administration, that if Israel does enter into Rafah with its army, that the Biden administration will consider curtailing military supplies to Israel for the first time.
So, I appreciate your time.
Anything was going to happen to it. Yeah.
That's just not true. The American people will rise up against the Democratic Party if they do that. Dr. Oren, thank you. Great to talk to you as always. I appreciate you joining me. I hope we can talk again on Thursday. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by my pal Jim Garrity. We labor together as contributors to The Washington Post, but he is working every morning at National Review with The Morning Jolt. Good morning, Jim. Good Monday to you. Jim, last night, Trey Gowdy put me on the spot and asked me to come on the running list for President Trump. Luckily, I had written for The Post about it this week, and I said that ought to be either Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo, Joni Ernst, or Glenn Youngkin or Doug Burgum. Then over the weekend, Politico put Doug Burgum out as the likeliest. What do you think? I'm kind of getting the Burgum bubble going here or playing with it. What do you think about that, Mr. Normal from North Dakota?
Yeah, boy, that would actually, first of all, I think your list is terrific. I am not a fan of the Carrie Lakes. There are candidates who are probably flashier. There are candidates who are probably more MAGA, who are more like Trump and would not broaden the appeal. And I don't think that's what Trump needs to do. Trump already has the appeal of all the Trump. He needs to win over the skeptics. There, you know, you saw Nikki Haley still get a decent number of votes in Pennsylvania, like a month after she left the race. There are a lot of folks who are right of center who are still skeptical. And the more normal, for lack of a better term, you can make the running mate, the more reassuring, the more straightforward, even-keeled. I mean, a Burgum would be a really pleasant surprise. And I think there are, you know, like Biden supposedly is going to be the return to normalcy. And Americans look all around at high prices and an insecure border and chaos overseas. And they say, this is not normalcy. Boy, you don't get much more normal and reassuring than Doug Burgum. Who, by the way, I think, you know, for going in as a skeptic in the presidential race, I think he acquitted himself pretty well, fought through the pain on that injury on the debate stage. I'd be really pleasantly surprised if that was the choice. I would not count on it, but
the only dark mark against Doug Burgum is that he's playing basketball in his 60s, and no one should play basketball in their 60s. It's like an Achilles tendon tear waiting to happen. You saw the CNN poll yesterday, Jim. And you were probably up too late. Maybe you didn't. You were probably at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner drinking until 3 in the morning with the glitterati. But I have
totally
an explanation.
I was actually celebrating Passover.
Okay. I have a list. I have a shorthand way of remembering the issues. A, B, C, D, E, I, E, I, I. Appeasement, border, crime. D, E, I. Education, inflation, and Israel. A, B, C, D, E, I, E, I, I. Why is Joe Biden's number so low? I mean, that CNN poll is a shocker. 6 points down among registered voters. They got every red light worrying that they can over at the White House.
Hugh, my first thought when I heard that acronym is that is the new diversity group that we're all expected to be sensitive to. The ABC, DEI, LMNOPP plus community. Or it was the latest group in the Pentagon that's managing our arms transfers to Taiwan, which I believe are moving as quickly and easily as a kidney stone. They have $17 billion worth of arms to Taiwan that they've already bought, they've already paid for, and we just haven't shipped over there, which is, to me, one of the great great problems in our foreign policy at this moment. Look, I could focus on any one of those issues, but I think just in general, on top of all, like, these are bad answers that the administration has. It comes from an 81-year-old man who looks every bit of those 81 years and is not getting any younger. Okay, fine. Like, you load up, you know, him with, I'm going to say, a double espresso. Unlike the former president, I will not say that Joe Biden is doing cocaine. Hell of a follow-up on that one, by the way. Great job, Hugh. What's more, as I don't think Joe Biden is on cocaine, but they can put him up with enough caffeine.
I did nail that down. You're right. I thought that shocked me, although that joke was used by the MC at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I didn't get credit.
Yes. I had said President steroids, and there was somebody who said, how can you make that kind of accusation? Don't you have any proof? You know, that kind of, nattering nabob who could not take a joke. Or say, I do not believe President Biden is taking steroids. If he was, I'd expect him to look and sound better than he does.
Yes.
But I, no doubt he's probably got something to, I'm going to assume ordinary caffeine. I'm going to assume perfectly legal substances.
Couple of Red Bulls in the back of the limo.
But look, he looks terrible. And I don't think anybody looked like there's some survey that said like 70% don't expect him to finish his term. Now, maybe he has to step down. Maybe at some point it's something like that. I don't think. But, you know, some people think that they just look at the actuarial tables and they just don't see this guy doing the job at age 85 or 86 if he's looking like it now. Like that's by far. That's, by the way, Biden could theoretically get better on Israel and Palestine. The economy could get better. He could take a tougher line on China instead of insisting, oh, we're going to see a thaw in our relations. Just you wait and see. But, you know, he can't change his age and he can't change the way he looks and he really can't change the way he sounds. And I think most Americans look at this guy and say they say, oh, it's not that. Look, we saw this guy as vice president for 8 years. We've seen this guy. We know what's normal for Biden. And the meandering tale of when he did the Stern interview and said he saved six people as a lifeguard and got arrested protesting desegregation. This was the guy who was, everybody's gotten tired of the corn pop stories. Everybody's gotten tired of the stories. Yeah, you know, in fact, and my uncle and I were fighting off the cannibals down in the New Guinea. And, you know, it's just this.
He has not sat for an interview with the New York Times. The New York Times. Not one interview. You. I got to play for you. No one in this audience knows.
Heartless twice. Jason Bateman, that's a tough questioner right there. There's you. The late Tim Russert and Jason Bate, or what's his name? Will Arnett. Those guys, you know.
Do you know John Ellis? Have you ever met John Ellis?
No, I read his stuff a lot. I like his stuff. I wish his stuff wasn't paywalled because it looks really good, the free excerpts that I read. Love his characterization of – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I like news items, but I was asked by Trey Gowdy last night about debates, and I said, I honestly don't know if they could come up with a moderator, even if the president would agree to it. I know the former president wants to do it every night. But then I began to think, you know, Ellis could be the moderator. Everyone kind of trusts John Ellis, don't they?
Isn't he distantly related to the Bushes, and somebody would complain
like
about that?
Like a second cousin once removed or something, but he's been in the news business for 30 years and he did Katie Couric's wedding ceremony.
Look, my theory is that Biden wants to look like he wants to debate, but will find excuses to not debate. Because I'm glad he told Howard Stern that he'd be happy to debate. Previous answers from Biden were like, well, if he behaves. And you see the likes of David Frum saying, oh, Biden should not dignify Trump, should not elevate him by appearing on the same. Now, look, I look at that, and first, I'll assume David Frump means what he says. But I hear that, I'm like, Biden's too old. He can't be on a debate stage for an hour and a half for 3 nights. Like, you can say whatever reasoning you want, but when an incumbent president's like, I'm just not going to do any of these debates, we can all look at it and say, okay, it's very, you know, like reading off a teleprompter in the State of the Union, that's not that hard.
But Jim, stay focused with me for a second on moderators. I really was perplexed when Gowdy asked me this last night. The congressman said, what do you think? I said, round table like Lieberman and Cheney, but I don't know who they'd moderate. I don't think there's anyone who's neutral left who's trusted. I really don't think there's anybody left. They'd each get to pick one, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah. Off the top, I wish we could resurrect Tim Russert. I liked how he asked tough questions of everybody.
Can't be done.
But my general sense is you should not turn down a debate over the moderators. Like, if you can't handle the moderator, you can't handle Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and the mullahs in Iran. Like, you know, like are you likely to get a biased moderator? Sure. But also, like, the lesson of the last – we only had two debates last time because of the Trump catching COVID. The more you let Biden talk, the more damage he does to himself, right? He ended up saying we're going to get rid of all – coal and natural gas and all that kind of stuff. In the first debate when Trump tried to bulldoze him, that actually went very badly because of all the crosstalk, we couldn't hear him. Biden is his own worst enemy often when you let his mouth just keep running. And that was 4 years ago. So my attitude would be, give us a moderator, give Biden as much time as possible. Sooner or later, that runaway mouth will either, you know, he'll definitely tell stories that aren't true. And the time he jumped in front of the bullet to save Martin Luther King. You know, and stories like Hugh, a lot of people don't remember this. And I don't brag about this very much, but, you know, and the guy who tried to shoot him, Malcolm X,
you know, what
me. You ain't pretty, black, you
pretty soon. He's going to be on the Maya Gaz when they grab that back from the Phnom Penh from the Khmer Rouge. He's going to have led the commandos on board the Maya Gaz.
I remember knifing my first Viet Cong.
Jim Garrity, always a pleasure.
If Jesus came from Mississippi, if tears began to rise, I guess I'll start at the beginning. It's a world of strange design.
Welcome back, America. The Mississippi song means I'm joined by John Campbell, co-host with Generalissimo of Look Through the Chaos podcast. Congressman Campbell, good morning. Where are you? Are you in Tornado Alley? Are you still there? Did you get down in the cellar last night?
Good morning, Hugh. And yes, I am in the beautiful Flint Hills of Kansas. And we were under a tornado watch on Saturday, but nothing came here. We were actually, we didn't even have particularly bad storms. We were right in the middle. We watched the storms on the Doppler radar go on to the north of us and to the south of us, but we were clear here. And there was only, I think there was one tornado spotted in far southern Kansas, right near the Oklahoma border, but where most of the damage was in Oklahoma with this particular.
Well, last night was real bad. I don't know if you checked from last night. Five people died last night, and I think it was Louisiana and Oklahoma. I'm glad you were safe. All right, since you were safe, talk about the tornado of that economic data dump we got on Friday. Boy, that was bad for the president. It's bad for America.
Yeah, it was. And it's just pointing towards stagflation. It just, everything looks like we're headed towards stagflation. Inflation numbers are up. The price of things is going up. The vast majority of listeners and to this show or watchers on Salem TV know this. We don't have to tell them that. They know that things are still going up in price and that inflation is reaccelerating and going back up. But at the same time, the numbers for economic growth are slowing down, and the economic growth, it's still there, funded by deficits. It's basically all that's fueling it right now. There's not really any growth in the economy. There's not any, very little productivity increases, and the sorts of things that generate substantive and lasting growth don't exist out there. And the only thing adding to GDP and creating growth is $2 trillion of deficits, where the government's just throwing $2 trillion out there in the economy, less than they're taking in and borrowing it. And so we're look like we're headed to that. The next stop in this economy is stagflation, which those of us who are around in the 70s know about that. And it's not very pleasant. It's the sort of thing that helped elect Ronald Reagan, frankly.
It's really tough on college graduates. There are no jobs because people don't want to expand. Congressman Campbell and I both used to sit next to each other in church. He was my congressman for a long time. He can sing, I can't. But I bring that up for this simple reason. He's in Kansas and I'm in Virginia because we're both California expats. There's a story in the Journal this morning, John, that California consumers of fast food are just suffering sticker shock because the new minimum wage went into effect and the prices of everything went up 15%. What people don't know is the poorer you are, the more fast food you eat because there are so-called cheap calories. You can actually pick up a meal. You used to be able to buy fast food at a fairly affordable price. I think that Joe Biden is going to get crushed by the lower income people who, for whom every day is a struggle. And they just saw their dollar store go to be their $2 store. They just saw the cheapest cut of meat double. They just saw their fast food go up. I don't know how he gets anyone to vote for him.
Well, this is a bifurcated economy. And if you have assets, so if you have a house, guess what? It's worth more than it was some time ago, probably, than it was a few years ago. If you have stocks, they've been up. You know, if you have Bitcoin, it's up. If you have gold, it's up. But if you don't have assets, if you don't have a lot of assets and you're renting an apartment and you're working paycheck to paycheck, then the inflation crushes you and you have nothing on the asset side that's growing to offset that. And so that is where I think a lot of the pain is. And there some people out there doing just fine. You know, they bought NVIDIA stock and it's up 400% or whatever. And they're happy and they think things are great. But that's a very small slice of the population. The majority of everyday working people are being hurt by inflation and they don't have enough assets that are going up in value to offset that. And even if they do, if they own a home, so their home is going up in value, that's great. But unless they sell it, they can't do anything with that money. And you've got to live somewhere. And in the olden days, people would go out and get a second mortgage. You know, my house went up $100,000 in value. Let's go put a second mortgage on it, take that money out, and we can enjoy that. That's fine, or that was fine some time ago. But now you're going to pay for that second mortgage 8%, 8.5%, 9%, maybe even 10%. And that makes that second mortgage extremely unappealing. You know, you mentioned California. I do have to say, because we are both expats from California, and I was born there in Los Angeles. When you look at the economy, it's much worse there. Unemployment there, I think last month, 5.3%. I believe there's only one state with higher unemployment. So as tough as things are nationally, in California, they're even worse. The growth is even less. The inflation is even higher. Their deficits are even worse. And it's as tough as things are nationally, they're much worse than California.
And Governor Newsom said, hey, all you new migrants who are coming in over Joe Biden's open border, come to California. We'll give you free health care. That was a really wise move. Congressman, I want to ask you about the story about I know you have a special sound effect for Gavin Newsom when you do Through the Chaos Pod with Dwayne. So I'm hoping to hear that today when you tape I love the foghorn. Dwayne won't let me have sound effects in my studio.
It's not a foghorn. It is
it's the Titanic.
Yes, because there's there's some indication there of oh, there's Dwayne.
Look at that
anyway,
forehead.
Titanic. That Gavin is on the bridge of the Titanic and it is cruising towards the iceberg and he doesn't care.
So, I want to ask you, I don't want another shot, Harley, of Dwayne's forehead, because that glare was just too much. There you go. I want to ask John Campbell about what Trey Gowdy, you know Trey from the time you were in Congress. Last night he gets me on and he plays, okay, you're going to be the Trump transition team manager. Who's going to be the vice president? I gave him my list of Cotton, Pompeo, Ernst, their soldiers, or Governor Youngkin or Governor Burgum. Then Politico puts out a piece, clearly from Team Trump. Doug Bergen's looking pretty good as the vice president. And, you know, both Youngkin and Burgum have one great big asset. They're normal. They're just mainstream conservatives. What do you think about Doug Burgum? Have you met him? I mean, he is a very charming, normal guy.
I have not met him, but I heard you talking about that. That would really surprise me. Let's go back to 2016 when Trump picked Mike Pence. And
another normal guy.
I had predicted that. But part of the reason was back in 2016, evangelicals didn't trust Donald Trump based on his personal background. There was no one more trustworthy to the evangelical community than Mike Pence and former governor of Indiana at that point, et cetera, in Congress, et cetera. And he filled that hole and helped give some people who should have voted for Donald Trump but were skeptical, and he gave them reassurance, which would be Christian evangelicals in 2016. I think he's going to look for someone to fill that a similar hole. Now, what you're saying is that the hole is, let's just call them mainstream everyday conservatives that maybe aren't populists. Okay. So they're traditional Republicans.
They're John Campbell.
Populist Republicans.
They're John Campbell.
You're probably right. I was going to say, I'm certainly more populist than I used to be, but I'm not in the.
Okay. The captivating Mrs. Campbell, the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. Normal, long-standing Republicans.
Fair enough. I don't think Doug Burgum made enough of a splash on that debate stage to bring those people along. I don't think people understand who he is or understand him that much. Youngkin's different. Youngkin has a national, even though he didn't run for president, he's known nationally, and he's done a lot in Virginia, and he would be different. I think he'd be... in my opinion, would be a better choice because I think he'd be more people would say, that guy. I heard of him. I know him. He's doing some very reasonable, good things there in Virginia. And Virginia's a big state. North Dakota, it's not to get a state.
All it is to get the 3 to 5% who want a normal Republican. By that, I mean somebody a balanced budget guy.
You're right. It's not to get a state. But all I'm saying is that people across the country pay attention to stuff that happens in Virginia, like they do in stuff that happens in New York or California, Michigan, Florida, Texas. They don't pay a lot of attention to what happens in North Dakota. And that's just reality.
They make energy up there, John. They make a lot of energy up in North Dakota. They would bring down the cost of energy.
They do. That's true. But one of the things you said is that a traditional conservative, me included, but a lot are worried about, is they don't see a lot of difference right now between Biden and Trump in terms of what would happen to the deficit going forward. And that Trump is he's a real estate guy. He loves debt. Back when in his final year in the White House, he encouraged negative interest rates, which is one of the worst fiscal ideas ever on the planet. And so somebody like a Youngkin or somebody like that might reassure fiscal conservatives that there's somebody there in the White House circle that is going to
target. Congressman, you're shooting at the wrong target. Would you stick around for another segment? Can I get you for one more segment?
Sure.
All right, stick around. We're going to talk to him during the break as well, because he's wrong, and I like it when he's wrong. He does not understand basic politics, even though he's been elected. How many times have you been elected?
I won 17 elections, but half of those were primaries.
Yeah, okay. Well, so he's won 17 elections, but he's wrong today, and I'm going to explain to you why after the break. Don't go anywhere, America, except over to Through the Chaos. Look Through the Chaos at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Because it's really a fabulous podcast, even though Dwayne's on it. And John Campbell does most of the talking. Dwayne just sort of leads the band, and we like it that way. Don't go anywhere. I'm giving you a hard time, radio blogger. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be back. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is myphdweightloss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is a, and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in... Anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I will play for you. Dr. Oren and I had a very spirited conversation during the break. I'll play for that next hour. I'm joined now by Selena Zito, of course, of the Washington Examiner, the New York Post, or the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, of everywhere that anyone can write anything. Selena, I actually retweeted Brad Todd, who was tweeting your column about the Pennsylvania results, and I hadn't noticed that. I really didn't notice that a bunch of Democrats didn't vote for Joe Biden. They voted for that Dean Phillips guy. What is that all about?
Pretty funny, huh? You know, everyone's talking about Haley, Haley, Haley. However, you had and they should, by the way. They absolutely should. What does that mean? Where do they go? Those are important questions. We asked those questions about John Kasich and Ted Cruz after that long, elongated primary in 2016. However, you had almost an equal amount on the Democrat side that either voted for Dean Phillips, who I don't even know if he's ever been in the state, and more importantly, they voted for no one. They voted uncommitted. They voted in write-in ballots. Now, all the write-in ballots won't be tabulated, won't be counted for several more weeks. But there was an uncommitted moment or movement in our state, very similar to what happened in Michigan, where people were not voting for Biden. Now, a lot of people think that's just a very far left stance. However, I talked to a lot of centrist Democrats, independent Democrats, who also voted uncommitted because for completely different reasons than the Free Palestine people, they are also unhappy with Biden. And they sort of, you know, jumped onto that movement as well. So we're looking at maybe, I mean, I don't know, but we're looking at well over 120,000 people combined voted for Phillips and or nobody.
Selena, I saw the CNN poll yesterday morning. Joe Biden is down by 6 points nationally among registered voters to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is ahead by 6 points. The internals are even worse. And a lot of that is support Israel in America, especially Jewish Americans, but also people like me who are Zionists and happen to be Catholic. There are a lot of people that support Israel and just think this is flabbergasting what they've done. They're incompetent and impotent and confused. What is the general sense about the president that you talk to people? Do they realize he's just an old man who's failing in front of us?
Yeah, so I like you, think that it's not going to be one thing, one big moment that unravels Biden's support among Democrats, in particular, not just far left, but all Democrats, wherever you fall in the spectrum. I think it's going to be a lot of little things. It's going to be a death by a thousand cuts. And a lot of those issues are going to be very localized. People are going to look at local things that they feel disappointed and or let down by. And you know, in Pittsburgh last night, you saw the University of Pittsburgh just on fire, shutting down streets in Oakland, which is the neighborhood where it sits, with these anti-Israel protests. And, you know, if you remember, Brad Todd and I had a chapter in our book called King Cyrus Christians, which was very much based on the support for not just the freedom of religion, but also for the Jewish people, because, you know, that's part of Catholicism and Christianity as well, is to protect and preserve the Jewish state. And so I think it's going to be a lot of things, even like Sheetz last week, when the day after the president comes to Pittsburgh, his administration sues Sheetz.
Yeah.
That was crazy. That's the most beloved place.
And they put out brand new regulations to completely kill coal. They think coal isn't an issue, but it's still an issue in Pennsylvania, isn't it?
Look, there's a reason why we're still called the Pittsburgh Steelers, even though we really don't make steel in Pittsburgh anymore, or very little of it. It's that identity. It's that my grandfather's father, that was part of our identity. And while coal has been diminished significantly, it's still part of an identity. It's sort of in your DNA. So when you go after it in a very negative way, you're going after someone's father or grandfather or great-grandfather or someone's neighbor or uncle. They don't understand the nuances of that association.
Now, you know, that's interesting you say that, Selena. My great-grandfather worked in the coal mines of Pennsylvania before he got enough money to go buy a farm in Saybrook, Ohio. So you're absolutely right about that. I think the Biden political team is the worst political team I've seen in my adult life. Selena Zito, follow her at Zito Selena on X, and to get every column that she writes, and she is particularly crucial in election year, head over to her website, selenazito.com, and sign up to get every column in a timely fashion, selenazito.com. Thank you. My Yinza Report always gets my Monday off to a good start.
But they couldn't stop Jack or the horses happening.
Good Monday, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Special double duty for the grand old pod today. Double duty meaning I'm going to attach it to the end of the highly concentrated Hugh pod to give a sample to everyone who listens to the highly concentrated Hugh pod of what they get if they go to the behind the paywall. All right. If you go to behind the paywall, you'll be able to get the podcast that is there every day. Now, I do it on Mondays, sometimes on Thursdays. Generalissimo does it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Generalissimo is always doing podcasts here. There's a lot of stuff behind the paywall, including every minute of every Hugh Hewitt show ever done, a whole bunch of other stuff, but you got to subscribe to it. So we're attaching it today to the end of Highly Concentrated Hugh. So if you haven't heard that music before, that's our Behind the Paywall podcast. I want to begin by, I didn't play this at all on the radio show because I don't want to give many attention other than among friends. I hate the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I've gone once. And the year that I went, first year I came back to D.C. And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. Got my tuxedo out, went up to the Washington Hilton. And it was in the Trump years, first year, 2017. And the president wouldn't come. So he sent Sarah Huckabee Sanders and this vicious, vulgar comedian whose name I cannot recall, nor do I want to look it up. Don't want to give her the honor. Attacked Sarah right in front of everyone. I mean, there's 10,000 people there. It really is the nerd prom. And I was disgusted by the whole thing, by the display, by the self-conscious adoration of each other, by the sniffing around, people looking for jobs. The only good part about it is when I got to meet Dennis Eckersley. They had decided that year to invite all of the Major League Baseball players in the area who were in the Hall of Fame. And I'm walking in, and up pops Dennis Eckersley in front of me and says, Hugh Hewitt, I love your show. And I went, abba-dabba-dabba-dabba. I get what the late, our friend, late friend, Frank Pastore said, jockophobia. I don't know how to interview sports people that I've watched my whole life and rooted for. But then I calmed down and we had a nice chat. Dennis Eckersley was a wonderful guy. And so that was it. And everything, and that was just walking in. Everything was downhill after that. So I don't go. I don't listen. I don't give it any attention. I think it's absurd. Journalism is not anything special. It's a craft. It's not a profession. They're not lawyers. A lot of them are not particularly bright. Some of them get paid a lot of money. Some don't get paid any money at all. You can't tell by virtue of any. No one wears a sticker. And I just think that jokes are never any good. Now, Slow Joe Biden was there, and he repeated the bloodbath lie. So let's play that. Cut 13.
On the third anniversary of January 6th, I went to Valley Forge. And I said the most urgent question of our time is whether democracy is still the sacred cause of America. That is the question the American people must answer this year. And you, the Prefress, play a critical role in making sure the American people have the information they need to make an informed decision. A defeated former president has made no secret of his attack on our democracy. He said he wants to be a dictator on day one, and so much more. He tells supporters he is their revenge and retribution. When in God's name have you heard of another president say something like that? And he promised a bloodbath when he loses again. We have to take this seriously.
All right, now, there's so much that's idiotic about that, but I want to focus on the fact that this came out the same day that CNN's poll that I did talk about on the show today, showing Donald Trump up 6 percentage points nationally among registered voters. It's a blowout poll. Part of it, most of it, almost all of it is, the guy's just too old, and the delivery there was terrible. And he's reading the prompter, obviously. But the blood libel stuff about he promised a bloodbath, no, he didn't. He said it's a bloodbath at the border, not talking about people dying, but talking about the number of people coming over. And everyone in their right mind has long ago dismissed that. But Joe thinks he can somehow persuade the American people to vote for an infirm, failing in front of our eyes, physically frail old man if he can scare them. But you know what? The least scary thing in the world are really old guys who are declining in front of your eyes. Then we had Colin Jost as the MC. Cut number 11.
It's also wonderful to be back in Washington. I love being in Washington. The last time I was in D.C., I left my cocaine at the White House. Luckily, the president was able to put it to good use for his State of the Union.
So you see, that's actually not very funny. Former President Trump brought that up. And so he stole for the former President Trump's line on this show 3 weeks ago. So apparently they got no writers for this. Cut number 12, a little bit more Colin Jost.
Like many of you here tonight, I pretend to do news on TV. My weekend update co-anchor, Michael Che, was going to join me here tonight, but in solidarity with President Biden, I decided to lose all my black support.
So you see, that is a commentary on the fact that the president's numbers are collapsing, and it's not that funny. It just isn't that funny. Now, I do want to go and pick up a couple of things I didn't play for you on the show today. Jake Sherman was on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan and George Stephanopoulos on This Week. Panic, real, genuine panic, has begun to seize the left-wing media. And George is left-wing, and that's fine. Jake is on Face the Nation. Margaret is left of center. She's not left-wing, but she's left of center. Jake is left of center. Jake used to do the show, but he didn't want to get up early and do video, so that's fine. But let's both hear them talking about, you know, this is a bad set of numbers from CNN for the president. I talked about on the show. Cut number 9.
We asked them now, okay, has it gotten better? And very few people say that it has. In fact, many say they feel it's gotten worse. And inflation is the reason that they say that. But what's also interesting is we asked them, okay, look back to the economy during the Trump years. Mm-hmm. How do you remember it? And the majority say they remember it as being good.
Because they forget about the pandemic.
Well, they seem to be skipping over the pandemic, and that's exactly what that tells you in their memory of this. But it also explains now when you ask them, okay, now let's look forward. They say, more say, they feel they'd be financially better off under Donald Trump. And that cuts directly to vote. And that is helping the former president.
You know, I don't think that's our Jake Sherman, is it? That's not our Jake Sherman. That must be a different Jake Sherman. We'll have to have Generalissimo check on that because I don't think that was Jake Sherman. In any event, they're panicked over there, those numbers. They're deadly for the current president, former president surging. Then George Stephanopoulos, it's his opening monologue. And like you, I don't watch George. I was at church yesterday, and we had a big wedding on Saturday, and I was chasing the grandchildren all the way. I'm a normal human being, and so I don't watch the Sunday shows. George Stephanopoulos, cut number 7.
Good morning, and welcome to This Week. Until now, no American president had ever faced a criminal trial. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment for retaining and concealing classified documents. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment or a state indictment for trying to overturn an election or been named an unindicted co-conspirator in two other states for the same crime. No American president had ever faced hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments for business fraud, defamation, and sexual abuse. Until now, no American presidential race had been more defined by what's happening in courtrooms than what's happening on the campaign trail. Until now. The scale of the abnormality is so staggering that it can actually become numbing. It's all too easy to fall into reflexive habits, to treat this as a normal campaign, where both sides embrace the rule of law, where both sides are dedicated to a debate based on facts and the peaceful transfer of power. But that is not what's happening this election year. Those bedrock tenets of our democracy are being tested in a way we haven't seen since the Civil War. It's a test for the candidates, for those of us in the media, and for all of us as citizens.
All right, so let's unpack this. There's not a single fact in the opening of the Sunday show on ABC. Now, I was on with Trey Gowdy yesterday, and I told him there's not going to be a debate because Joe Biden can't debate, but if there was a debate, I'd have one fair moderator and a round table and President Biden and President Trump. But that there aren't any fair moderators. I mean, there just aren't. Everybody's in the bag. And so if you went to any of the major networks and you said to any of them, and I put Fox in a different category, I think Bright could do it. I think Shannon Bream could do it. I think Martha McCollum could do it. But Biden won't accept Fox. So everybody else in the media, anybody else out there that could be fair, do you think that was fair? That was just silly. That was a Democratic Party campaign ad. And I really don't know that ABC, I don't know what's going on at ABC. I have no idea what they're thinking about, how in the world they think that is winsome, how in the world they think that's going to help them with ratings. But George owns the show. He's got seniority. He got a long contract. So he is turning it into a must-win panic mode. Total, complete panic mode among Democrats, because they look at those numbers. They look at the swing state numbers last week from Bloomberg. They look at the national numbers from CNN. They look at the internals on Israel. Oh, my goodness. Guy Benson did the most amazing. I got to find that tweet and read it to you. Guy is so smart. And he actually spends time with these internals. And I don't, because it's a little bit early for me, but I nevertheless read what people like Guy put up. And he put up a takedown of the number yesterday. I retweeted it myself because I couldn't believe how bad it was when it came to the president's numbers on Israel. But Guy was very active yesterday, so I'm looking for it. And, you know, he's very mad at Northwestern, his alma mater, because they're melting down among all the other people. He did a couple of things. Most significantly, in the CNN poll, yes, it's one poll. In 2020, double disapprovers, voters who disapproved of both Trump and Biden, broke heavily for Biden. Right now, among the nearly 1 in 5 double disapproved votes, Trump leads by 12 points. Got that? So it is so huge of a win. But then Guy also writes this. Horror show of a CNN poll for Biden. Trump ahead outside of the margin of error, up even with bigger with expanded field. That would include Jill Stein and Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West. Majority see Biden's presidency as a failure, Trump's as a success. 60% disapproval for the incumbent. I want to focus on the Israeli war data point for a moment. Biden is at a dreadful 28-71, 28% approve, 71% disapprove, on his handling of the Israel-Hamas war. Media will focus on him being underwater, 1981, on the issue among young voters, pushing the narrative that he's still seen as too pro-Israel. But he's relatively strong on the issue among partisan Democrats, 46-53, among Republicans and independents, who are much more pro-Israel than the Democratic base at this point. He's at 13% approval, 87% disapproval, and 27% approval, 73% disapproval, respectively. Biden has pandered hard to the Hamas sympathizers for weeks. This guy continues, has earned Biden approximately zero credit within that crowd. Meanwhile, normies, normal people, people who follow a little bit of politics, meanwhile, normies and Israel supporters are, quote, disgusted with his handling of the issue. He's impressing no one. And Israel supporters heavily outnumber Israel haters in America, despite what might be seeing in his behavior on his favorite cable news channel, on social media, and among his hyper-online staff. Now, that is the key. I listen to Commentary Pod every day. It's where I get my exercise from. And Commentary Pod, John Podhorth has been putting out the theory for months that Joe Biden's just no good at this. He's a terrible candidate. He actually doesn't have a clue as to what he's doing. And his political team is worried. He won't take wins. He walks into walls. And this is not the physical infirmity part. When I say walking into walls, he just does dumb political stuff, like trying to have it both ways on Israel, which is impossible to do. And he had good Israel credentials until this war began, and he threw them out the window. Jake Sullivan was pronouncing the region the most, you know, Trey Gotti brought that up last night when I was on Trey. And it would be funny if it were not so tragic in the Middle East that Joe Biden is so incompetent that everything is on fire. Ukraine is on fire. Afghan has fallen under the Taliban, and now Israel's under attack north, south, east, west, and from Iran over the horizon. And it's all on Joe Biden's watch. And as I mentioned on the show today, even if the Fed cuts, the day of ultra low rates are over. The economy sucks. You hurt, I hurt, everybody hurts when prices go up and interest rates go up and your children have to, they call up and they say, gosh, did you see what we paid for groceries? My daughter's got four kids out on the West Coast and she always tells me her grocery bill. Not looking for money, just likes to complain to someone who understands how bad it is. Joe Biden's going to get beat. And that's why I spent so much. You got to go back to the beginning of the pod, listen to what I talked about with Trey Gowdy, because that was the best part. I want to review my notes a little bit. One of the things about when you go on a show like Trey, you make notes beforehand, you never get through it. And I had intended to get to the point about deep selecting a new Joint Chiefs of Staff. I don't know if Chuck Brown is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I don't know if he's good or bad. I don't know about the CNO and the Chief of Staff of the Army and the Commandant of the Marine Corps. I don't know about any of these people. But I know that there's a that Joe Biden has been on the warpath, weeding out good generals, just like Obama did for 12 years. So for 16 of the past 20 years, merit has not been at the top of the chart for generals and admirals. So they're going to have to remake into a warfighting department. And by doing that, I expect Donald Trump to go in and do some deep selects. And he may get some people off the bench, which, by the way, you can do that. If you retire as a general officer, you're always subject, ready to recall. Then go back and say, hey, Admiral McRaven, we thought you did a pretty good job with the SEALs. We'd like you to come back and be the CNO. They do whatever they want. And I expect, I didn't get to that part with Trey Gowdy last night, the part you already heard on the program this morning. State, the Department of Defense, the Attorney General, the FBI, the DNI, that's Director of National Intelligence, the CIA, I didn't get to that, you know, in a coherent, rational order. But I will tell you, there's a deep bench of very competent people who, if I hope, the former president names some of them, not just as vice president at the convention or before the convention, but he gives a list of his national security team because he knows who he wants. He's going to bring in a bunch of serious people, get rid of this clown car that has driven the Middle East to the brink of a regional war 2 weeks ago. And but for the craftiness of Netanyahu and Gantz and the Gallant, the three members of the war cabinet and their advisors, we would have done that. We would have seen a regional war explode because they're getting no leadership from the White House. And the White House thrown in with Israel, said, let's go get Rafah right away instead of this long, drawn-out bloodbath. Maybe his numbers would be better, but he can't. As Robert Gates said, he's been wrong about everything for the past 40 years. Now it's 50 years. He's still wrong about everything, and America knows. And the CNN poll underscores that. That's it for today's Grand Old Pod. That's a taste for those of you who got this added on today to the highly concentrated Hugh Pod. If you want to get this every day and you want to get Generalissimo, and he does a lot of great stuff on the after show, you have to belong to the universe. So consider this an ad for the universe. You belong to a lot of things. Make sure you get the entire show, every guest, all of our after shows that are behind the paywall by subscribing to the Grand Old Pod. That wraps it up for the extended edition of the Highly Concentrated View, within which is included the Grand Old Pod. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, Generalissimo. I'll talk to you tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.